Thou art saved.
The living room's dark, save for light being cast from the big TV screen and the imminent sunrise that's teasing the one starry sky with whispers of morning.
Hey, it's Mike again.
Yeah, I never left.
Hey, it's still Mike.
I just don't have comments on every game.
I understand. Some games are not worth not worth your brain power. But this one, this game is.
Yes. Link's Awakening, the first Zelda on Game Boy, and in the grand scheme of things, I guess that would make it the fourth Zelda game they ever made.
One and two
on the NES.
Yeah.
Link to the Past.
Link to the Past, then this one. Were there any, did they get any weird spin-offs? Like, is there like a Zelda's Cookie or like a Zeldamon Snap or some crazy?
I'm actually not sure that has ever happened.
No, I'm afraid it has because...
Oh, we're not talking about CDI.
Okay, that was a completely appropriate reaction. But on the Wii U, there was the weird bow training game.
Oh, you're right.
And then they also did Hyrule Warriors, which like makes no damn sense.
Yeah, it's the Dynasty Warriors with a fresh coat of Nintendo branding.
Yeah. Yeah, so not never, but certainly rarely. They don't just
compared
slap
to Mario, who is just slapped on anything that's living or might live someday.
Yes, yeah, they're a little bit more judicious with Zelda, which
there's
I
no
appreciate.
Link is missing, or
oh Jesus, Link teaches typing. So we played Link's Awakening for the Game Boy, and I think it is worth noting that. I never played this game as a kid, but I did realize after playing it that I was exposed to this game because I remember Brian playing the original. Two, the original came out in 1993. We played the Game Boy Color remake, which came out in 1998, and I'm really, really glad we did that because looking at like screenshots side by side, you're like, ooh, original Game Boy. Four, eight, or H, or whatever one I'm on now, there is a remake of this coming out, and the timing of this episode is not at all circumspect. So maybe some SEO goodness off of the Switch remake, but we played the 1998 Game Boy one.
Yeah, and so to counteract your lack of nostalgia other than... osmosis of your friend. I did play it when it came out. I had the original Game Boy growing up. I have lots of nostalgia for whatever that famous webcomic is of the kid in the car with every little street light lighting his game for
I
one
love
second.
That comic. That's so cute.
And so I had those family road trips where I was desperate for any form of light. I had weird, there was a weird era of lots of attachments to the Game Boy to have magnify the screen or give you bigger buttons and of course lights because there wasn't a backlit Game Boy for a long time.
Did the original Game Boy also have the crazy thing that was shaped like batteries but then had a cord so you could plug it into a wall?
I don't remember that. I don't think you had an AC option. It was always batteries.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of the Game Gear. I know there was some handheld console that had like plug these fake batteries in with a rat tail coming off of it.
I mean, maybe some like unofficial third party thing.
Ooh,
came
yeah,
out like
fair,
that.
Fair play.
Yeah, there was a kind of a playground of adapters. None of that matters for Zelda, but it was just part of the nostalgia. It was also, I mean, this game came out and it was kind of part of a wave of the Game Boy getting, quote, real games and not just either really awful ports of console games or, very, very simplistic, like arcade, like one screen or few screen games. This joined the ranks of Metroid 2 and, Capcom did a really good job porting most of their games like Bionic Commando and DuckTales and Mega Man. And
didn't the first Mega Man game they put on Game Boy only have four Robot Masters almost, instead of six, or six instead of eight?
Yeah, it only had four, and And then the subsequent games were weird because they would take four from two and four from three, or like they would start mixing them up. It was weird.
They went full Final Fantasy naming and they were like, we messed it up. We'll just never fix it.
And then they had five, which was completely made up. So, I mean, this was, so Link's Awakening was Nintendo making a true AAA game for Game Boy, which was refreshing given that there's a lot of shovelware on Game Boy.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, because you said this indirectly, but I want to be really explicit that I did not realize in my memory when in the Zelda like series this came out. And I think it's really important for someone who has played this game as a kid and didn't realize this, or who has never played this game and is considering, you know, playing the original or now playing the remake that's going to come out later sometime. This came out after A Link to the Past. And the reason I think that matters so much is when you play the original Zelda for Nintendo, you're like, oh my God, this is like iconic. And there's a bunch of stuff that's dumb and I hate, but you can see the foundation that they're laying. And then you play Zelda 2 and you're like, oh my, what is happening? Right. And it's just, it's miserable. And then you play A Link to the Past. And in my mind, and I know I don't represent everyone, or at least I represent all the smart people. In my mind, Link to the Past is like the definitive Zelda. Like it is.
Yeah.
It's my favorite personally, but it's just like, it's so good. And there's so much that was established right there in that game. And then knowing that this game comes after is important because so much of what they do in this game that we're going to talk about is, I don't think they would have come up with all these ideas if this was a game for Game Boy before the Super Nintendo one. This was essentially them trying to take all of the goodness of the Super Nintendo one and shove it into 4-bits and getting surprisingly close to that goal.
Absolutely. Not to give away our feelings on it, but
no, it was terrible. Or was it great? Who knows? No, but I mean, like, the, in terms of mechanics and like interesting little level design things that they tried, like, knowing that this came after Link to the Past makes so much more sense, because if this game had come first, then you would be like, oh my God, this is where all the groundwork was laid for Link to the Past. But really, they had the way more powerful system, and then they had to decide how to cram all of that game design down into, you know, half as, or what, a quarter as many bits, way fewer bits.
You know, there's still some interesting experimentation happening in this game, but you can tell that the Zelda, the paradigm, was really figured out by the time they got to this game, and the riffs on it aren't as extreme as you trace the first three games, and they're wildly different. And I mean, I think a lot of Nintendo's franchises started to set in the Super NES era, like, we kind of know what this is.
And Yeah, I agree. They were sort of like, okay, this will be the definitive one, and now we will branch off of this. We're not going to remake the mold every single time.
Yeah. Lots of nostalgia for me. It's a real serious attempt at a full game, and so let's talk about visuals.
Let's talk about visuals. I think it matters that we played the color one just because it's in color, and I like the Game Boy Color. I like the simple flat colors that the Game Boy Color was good at. But this game, like a lot of Nintendo games, lends itself incredibly well to really simple sprite art. I mean, I've made no secret of my love of sprite art. I feel very personally insulted when sprite art is done poorly and something looks like garbage, because it's such a nostalgic art form. And Link as a little elf character, and the little monsters, and the very kind of game board tile layout of the things like trees and rocks and stuff just works incredibly well on the Game Boy. And even little things like the fact that the rocks and the pots are exactly the same size, which is exactly one tile, which is exactly how big Link is. Like, your brain just sees like the kind of cartoony, I've always called them tokens in the past. They're like game tokens, right? And the fact that they're the same size, just like, your brain is like, no, this is fine. Because it's so simple and cartoony that you just make your peace with it, really.
Yeah, and even though we played the color version of the game, this game had to live on top of a design that worked with four shades, which is all the Game Boy can do.
Yeah.
And I was trying to look this up. It's not like four shades and blank white. It's literally four shades total. And so everything they have to communicate in this game has to make sense to your eye with only that much contrast to work with. And I think they do an incredible job. They show off like just the number of environments in this game. The beach, there's a forest, there's a swamp, there's a desert, there's waterfalls and lakes, there's mountains. And they basically have to do that with the shape and contrast, not with color.
Well, and there's indoor environments, right? So there's you go underground, there's stone dungeons, there's inside houses that have like wooden beds and you know, wooden floors, there's fire, there's like some torches and things, and you know, you get the magic rod that makes fire toward the end. But yeah, there's a gigantic amount of information that's communicated through shapes mostly, then textures, and then third, I guess maybe movement. Some things like the way they move gives you a lot of information, or they flash colors or whatever. But the color upgrade exists only because that they were replacing the original version. So the fact that they were able to successfully make the game at all with all that information in those four colors, and you're right, it is literally four colors total. And then to add in, what did the Game Boy Color have, like 16 colors, 24?
I think 56.
56. I wouldn't have picked that number out of the air. so that many colors is, I don't know what to call it. Like, it's not like repainting the house, because like it's the way you probably imagined it, especially coming off of the Super Nintendo Zelda. Like, you as the player probably have an idea in your mind of like, oh, Link is colored roughly like this, and the world is colored roughly like this. And then when you think back, if you had played the original, you're probably kind of remembering it the way the Game Boy Color one actually looked, right? So even just 5 years apart, they sort of had to compete with, how did people imagine this thing looked when it wasn't in color? And now we have to try and match their memory.
And the geek in me wonders if they like programmed it well or not, or if they like, if everything was just like, yeah, shade one, shade two, and then when they had to colorize it, if they had to go in and change a lot of foundational descriptions of the color.
I bet they did. I bet they did, because once you can differentiate between things like blue and green or red and green, then just saying like, oh, this color was the dark green before, and it's like, now should it be like red and pop and be really separate from the rest of the environment, or should it be like a blue and kind of blend in with the rest of the green environment? So I just took it for granted here that the rest of the environment is green. But yeah, so I would say, based on how well this looks, how good this looks, they probably did go back and methodically recolorize things and not just be like, brah.
And I doubt they would have the time or budget to foresee the Game Boy Color 5 years ahead of time and
be
like, oh, we should add an extra, you know, variable for the color, not just the shade. But there's a lot of cameos in this game of Nintendo characters from other games. See if I miss any here. There's Wart from Mario 2. There's Yoshi. There's apparently a Kirby somewhere. I don't remember seeing it on this playthrough.
It's in the seventh dungeon, I think.
Okay. Don't remember. He's one of the enemies?
It's an enemy, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Wright from SimCity.
Yeah, that one's somehow the weirdest.
Chomp, who you get to actually take on a walk. There's Goombas and Piranha Plants. And there's probably even a few more. There's just, I don't remember them doing, was there any Nintendo characters in Link to the Past? I
cannot think of any. And I literally have in my notes, has any other Zelda game more proudly worn its made by Nintendo shirt? Because they just, like, because, you know, I first started playing, and like one of the first Nintendo-y things you're exposed to is the Chain Chomp, because it's on like the second screen. And it's like, oh, I get it. That's cute, because it's a Nintendo game. Okay, I get it. And then, like, as the game goes on, you just see more and more, mostly Mario, but, like, non-Zelda Nintendo stuff just in the world, and not there as like a cute reference. Like the Chain Chomp is a core part of one of the early missions, quests. The Mr. Right is like a core part of one of the side missions. The frog, what's the frog's name?
Wart.
he is a core part of the game. Like you have to go and interact with him to learn the frog song, right? Like there's all of these Nintendo things. The Goombas are enemies you have to interact with. Just all this Nintendo stuff that's just like, hey, Zelda is part of the Nintendo franchise. It's like, it's almost weird. Like maybe as a 10-year-old, I would have been like, ah! But in my 30s, I'm like, huh.
Yeah, and I mean, right down to the very giant iconic structure on the top of the mountain that you go to end the game is a Yoshi egg.
Yeah, no, it totally
pretty
is.
Pretty much.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. They made the dots pink instead of green, but yeah, it's basically a Yoshi egg.
Well, there's pink Yoshis.
Don't they all have green eggs? No, they do have different colored eggs. Yeah, you're right.
Another visual thing that's just before we get to gameplay is a lot of the dungeons, not all of them to my eye, but a lot of them carry the Zelda 1 thing of being shaped like things. So the key cavern looks like a key. The bottle grotto kind of looks like the outline of a bottle. The angler cavern looks like a fish. And Turtle Rock looks like a turtle. And I wasn't able to identify any other ones, but that's enough to be like, yeah, they did this on purpose.
Yeah. No, because I didn't think to look at the full laid out maps in like high res, and in game they are blocky enough that didn't jump out at me. But I know that that's a thing Zelda games have done, because it's just you as the player never really see the map laid out with screens, right? You see the blocks for the rooms, but then like if you look at it in like a Nintendo Power or a game guide or something and you see the whole thing laid out, then it's usually a little bit more obvious. They sometimes are like color coded too. I think like the first Zelda, they were like kind of color coded. So I sort of love the idea of like, here are the shapes that are part of the theme of the dungeon, and it's not necessary. It doesn't do anything, but we did it anyway because we did.
Yeah, knowing that the key cavern looks like a key, it's not like it solves a puzzle for you or like gives you a, like, I wouldn't know that there's a secret door over here.
Nope.
Or anything.
Yeah, it's just one of those things, kind of, in a way, kind of like all of the other cutesy Nintendo things. Like, it's just because the designers could do that. So they just included lots of cutesy stuff, and the layout, the levels have to be, or the dungeons have to be shaped like something. So making them shaped like their theme is just okay. Yeah. What do you think about the, frankly, unique, as far as I know, in the Zelda franchise, flip-flop between top-down traditional 2D Zelda and then, whoa, platforming sections just, like, thrown in? And I don't want to talk about the mechanics yet. We'll get to that. But, like, visually, it is the exact same sprite for Link. Some of the sprites that are in there, like the backgrounds and things, are unique to those 2D sections. But do you feel like it works? Is it jarring? I know they kind of did that in Zelda 1, but not like this. Not all of this platforming and jumping. And oh, by the way, you could jump in this game.
Yeah, the side-scrolling sections they're kind of strange because they didn't really do any new artwork. Link looks exactly the same. If you point Link looking up, he's just, it's like you're above his head and he's facing upwards on the overhead view. And so there's a little bit of weirdness there. And I mean, you get the sense that like the game engine has kind of been hacked to make it, to add some gravity to an otherwise the same game engine. And yeah, it's a little weird visually. Like it comes off as like kind of they forced it in a little.
Yeah. And it's because the visuals down there are straight on, right? Like you, when you see a platform, you're looking right at the side of it, not like at kind of a gentle angle. Like everything in there just feels like it's from a different game. And some of those platforming sections I kind of enjoyed. I was like, oh, okay, like I get to jump over this thing, or there's this little like puzzle with the ice blocks and the fire wand, the magic wand that I need to solve. Like that's kind of interesting, but visually it feels very out of place. Like you swap the cartridges really fast in between loading screens.
And I mean, I could trace it to something from Zelda 1. They never made it like a full gameplay moment, but when you would get items in Zelda 1, you would kind of be in a view like that, and there might be bats, but there's basically nothing that happens there.
Yeah, they're like little crawl spaces where you like go down the ladder and you go over and you go up another little ladder, and then the item's right there. And I get why they wanted a screen that was like, here's the item, right? And like that was all they cared about on that screen, and they wanted to like accentuate it. But in Link's Awakening, these are like substantial platforming segments required to progress through dungeons. It's not like you could just say like, oh, there's this silly thing on the side. Like it is a core part of every dungeon, or at least most of the dungeons.
And reminds me that there are thwomps in this game too. One of the cameos I missed.
Yes, you did. There are absolutely thwomps.
Which, I mean, we'll get to the mechanics, but the whole Zelda as platformer angle of this game is, I think, one of the like stay in your lane Zelda kind of things we'll get to.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. I don't love the way those sections behave mechanically, which we'll definitely dig into more. But I really, even just thinking about the visuals, I don't really like the way they look. And then musically, and we don't have segue right into music right here if you have more stuff to say on the visuals, but like they also do weird things with the music. It's like those entire sections, visually, auditorially, and mechanically, are all like from a different game, and they just didn't want to scrap that work, so they put it into this game.
Yeah, I do have a few more visual things. So I'd say you brought up the idea of Zelda as a very tiled game. It's there's a lot of puzzle mechanics to Zelda, so the visuals of the tiles have to explain a lot or present you with things you can use for the gameplay. And so the tiles in Zelda communicate what can be done or give you hints about what might be possible, and often in relationship to your items. So if there's cracks in the wall, you might be able to blow it up. If there's rocks and pots, you can pick those up and you can hit things with them. If there's water, you quickly learn that you can't swim until you get the flippers. Cracked floors, if you stand on them too long, you're going to lose half a heart because you're going to fall. And, you know, the game is structured to mix these things up. And so I'd say in general, they do a really good job visually of giving you iconic things that trigger your memory of like, oh, yeah, I got to pick that up. Oh, yeah, I got to dash through that.
Yeah, and with very rare exceptions, they don't break their own visual cue rules. If something is a thing, it behaves that way every time you see it. And the few exceptions there are, like there's the rock that kind of looks like the tip of a pencil. It's like zoomed way in on the pencil lead. After you get to a slightly more advanced part of the map, you start to encounter the little crab things that are like under the rocks. So you get near the rock and you think like, haha, I'm going to pick up this rock because I have the power bracelet. And then it like rushes over and hits you and you take some damage, right? So I feel like that's an acceptable, because like it doesn't, you don't fall out of the dungeon, right? It doesn't, it's not a one-shot kill. You don't lose items or anything stupid like that. So it teaches you to a little bit more cautiously approach rocks. But if you decide not to be cautious, or you just don't internalize the lesson, the penalty for failure is just being reminded that the world is not always as simple as it seems, right? And I feel like if you're going to have all of these super clear visuals that tell you exactly what they do so that you can use that knowledge to solve puzzles, when you break those rules, the penalty needs to be pretty low. And all the times I can think of, they keep the penalty pretty low.
Yeah, they didn't even give you the stupid big hand that warps you out of the dungeons.
No, they have the stupid boxer mini boss who knocks you out of the
dungeons. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God. The first time that happened to me, I was like, what? What? What?
Oh, that's a strange character. A note on text in this game, which I have to get to in visuals. I'd say, so anytime we're going to play an RPG and I choose to comment on that episode, I'm going to talk about how fast does the text appear and are there any paper cuts around that. It's just a given in RPGs.
No, totally.
And I'd say my overall review of text in this game is mediocre to sometimes frustrating. And it's not as fast as I'd like. And I want to ask you, how many times trying to speed through a conversation did you accidentally start it over by talking to him again?
Yeah, like all the times, because most of the things people have to say are not that important. And I would call myself a pretty hardcore RPG-er, and the Zelda games are, for better or worse, are action RPGs, which means not a ton of information is conveyed through like interacting with the NPCs, right? There's the owl in this one that comes in and like tells you what to do. And a lot of action RPGs have like a narrator slash guide of some kind, but you don't generally just walk around and like chat with the townspeople. But because I play a lot of RPGs, I do that, even though I shouldn't, because I know it's not really necessary in these games. So you end up talking to someone and they say the same dumb thing that they've said every other time you've talked to them. And then you just start like spamming A to get through it. And then you accidentally start the conversation over again. And you're just like,
In general, they did seem to be having a lot of fun with the characters in this game. They're very sarcastic. They're very fourth wall breaking.
Tons of fourth wall breaking.
The guy who gives you tips over the phone, if you go to his house, he's like terrified. Like, please, can you just go somewhere else and call me? Which is maybe a little future looking. Yeah, to right? Like, don't want to interact with people. Can you just like text me? But I'd say this game also started a trend of over-helping, or maybe didn't start, but was a significant increase in Nintendo trusting players less, and specifically with the visual text appearing on screen. And one of the things that is a huge paper cut in this game is the way I understood the mechanic is, say you touch a rock and you don't have the glove, it's going to tell you, hey, wow, this thing looks heavy. You need the gloves. And every time you go to a new screen and bump one of those rocks or pots, it's going to say it again. And I hate that design choice.
Yeah, and this is definitely going to come up again in mechanics, but I think it's important to understand it visually because the text is not that fast, and there's no way to disable this text. So every single time you interact with anything that requires an item to interact with, the gameplay comes to a grinding halt, right? So visually, like if there's enemies on the screen, everything just freezes in place. And then the text box opens and it's like, oh man, this rock sure looks heavy, right? Like just like you said, like literally every single time. And then, okay, well here, you know what? This is my teaser for mechanics. I have a lot more to say about this. But yeah, let's just say for now, to relate it to visuals, that the fact that everything on the screen freezes and the text box jumps up and you have to slowly crawl through two or three screens of text, because I mean, it's a Game Boy, right? And you can't fit a ton of text on there. So you have to like go through two or three little like window scrolls of text. And it's just every time, like every time, like this is the opposite of overhelping.
It's helping so much that it's hurting.
Yeah. Oh, God. Now all I can think about is the part of the episode that's going to be us talking about that. Anything else for the visuals?
No, I think, I mean, we'll cover more with mechanics. I'm sure we'll think of stuff, but that's good.
I have a totally awesome segue into audio here. You ready for this? Ready? So you mentioned that they do a pretty good job of telegraphing, like this is a floor tile that if you stand on it for too long, you're going to fall through it. And then over here is a wall that if you bomb, you can go through it. What they introduced in this game, and I honestly can't recall happening in any other Zelda games, but I've missed a few in the middle years. There are walls that don't look different, but if you tap them with your sword, they make a noise that's different. And that's how you know that wall can be bombed. And I think it's actually, considering the Game Boy's incredibly limited hardware power, I think it's a pretty clever mechanic to say, oh, well, we have a way for people to explore the world visually. Do we have any ways they can explore the world audio-terially, phonically is probably the right way to say that. And I can't think of any other Zelda game where that's how you find bombable walls. And I thought
Link to the Past did that, didn't it?
If it did, I have successfully played that game a bunch of times without ever having to do that.
It might not, and maybe I'm just remembering from this game, but I feel like you can do that in Link to the Past, and that would make sense that they would include it, but yeah.
But either way, I do think it's a clever mechanic because so much of the information is conveyed visually, and there's very little information that is only conveyed through audio, and exploring the world through audio is a perfect fit for the Zelda universe, right? It's like the whole point of the game is exploration and, like, you know, having an adventure in this world. And it makes sense that you wouldn't only do that with your eyes. You would use other senses to get around the world. So yeah. I actually thought that was a pretty cool thing to include, even if a few times I would, like, open up, you know, Game Facts or something, and they were like, oh, poke this wall, and that's the part of it that you can bomb. And I was just like, so, like, I didn't know.
It also seemed that mechanic, though, also seems like something that on Game Boy is something that a lot of gamers might miss because they might be playing silently just because of where
silently
they are.
Silently or in a super noisy environment. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is questionable that that's the system they chose to include that mechanic on for the first time. But I do think it is a clever mechanic that is also on theme for, you know, you exploring the, you know, using your wicked cunning to explore the world around you. So that was a neat thing. And I think a solid segue into audio.
Yeah. I guess one thing I'd say is, every single, item you get, special item you get in this game has a unique sound, which I think is like the hookshot sounds different than the boomerang, sounds different than a bow, sounds different than a bomb, sounds different than, I don't think any of them sound the same, which is, I think, remarkable given what the Game Boy's sound chip is capable of doing. You know, when you fall, there's kind of a slide whistle. Yeah, if you step into a door, you get a ch-ch-ch, like you're taking footsteps upstairs. When you break a pot versus breaking a boulder, and like I could see a world where a game designer gets lazy and they're like, well, when you break a rock and when you set a bomb off, it can probably be the same sound. Like, whatever, stuff's kind of, but no, it's different. My favorite sound effect of almost all time is hating a boss in a Zelda game, because there's always just like really satisfying when you kill him, you get the longer and I can't think of a better sound than that to reward you.
No, and I'll bet on, because, you know, I play this on a Super Game Boy on a television, like an adult, but I bet on a Game Boy speaker, that probably sounded very like guttural animal, you know, you're slaying a monster, right? And it probably came out of that little tiny cheapo speaker and was like monster sounding, right? And then now, like, yeah, on a big television, it's a little more guttural crazy. And I know this has been re-released on the virtual console and stuff, so like most people who've played this game now have probably played this on like modern equipment, which is hilarious. Yeah. But even on, you know, big speakers on a big television, like, it still sounds really good. Like, the music still sounded really good. The differentiation of the sound effects still helps you navigate the world and understand what's going on and knowing which items you just used. Like, it scales up surprisingly well in terms of audio.
How'd you feel about the music?
Okay, so it's pretty good. Like, I enjoy this music a lot. I'm always excited to get a new variation in a mainline Zelda game on the Hyrule theme, the iconic Zelda music. But it's executed in a really smart way in this game. I think I have this later in my notes, but now seems as good a time as I need to bring it up. Like, you do the little opening of the game and you don't hear the Zelda music. And then when you go to the beach and you get your sword, that's when it switches over, and it's like, now it's the like dun 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 dun, 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 and it's like, because you spoilers, you don't get the Master Sword in this game, or the sword you're walking around with is the Master Sword. There's no like moment of, there's no like clear moment of growth. So picking up your sword and like going back to being Link, the hero of awakening, is like, it's a super triumphant moment, even though it happens in like the first, you know, 2 minutes of the game. And coupling it with that super iconic music that has a really cute little arrangement on the Game Boy, like, felt really good. Like, it wasn't just, oh, this is a good song, I know this song. Like, they chose to roll it out in a moment that made it feel even more powerful.
Totally agree. Some of the other music is not so great.
Well, they can't all be winners, Mike.
And I'll save a certain one for you to talk about, but I'll talk about the Ocarina songs. And so I'd say the Ballad of the Windfish is probably the best new Zelda theme that comes out of this game. By the end of the game, you get all 8 instruments, and it kind of goes through a medley of letting each of them kind of make some noise. And I just think, like, as far as like a chiptune-y orchestra, it's gorgeous. Like, it's really well done. And but then the other Ocarina songs, I think, are hot garbage and worthless and nothing I would really want to listen to.
No, and you can kind of see them thinking to like future games where they would have more powerful audio hardware, right? Because Link to the Past has the Ocarina, but it only has the one song used to summon the bird, right? And you hear it, I think, at like 2 or 3 different speeds, but it's the same melody. Whereas in this, every time you accidentally go over the Ocarina in your menu, it opens up the stupid submenu.
Oh, right. We didn't talk about that.
Yeah, because there's 3 songs. There's the Wart song, Marin's song, which is the main one that you wake the windfish with. And then there's like a hidden one that you don't need to beat the game that like warps you the one around.
Yeah, because the Wart one's how you revive things, which you need to get the flying chicken. But the other one just transports you to the whatever Tracy's cabin or whatever.
Yeah.
The little water puddle next
to her. Yeah, so I didn't even get that one, but the other two are like, they're okay. Like the full, you know, Song of Awakening like sounds pretty good, but like the little melody you burp out on the Ocarina is like, is not their best deployment of the sound technology on a Game Boy.
Which is, I mean, fine. You're just using it to do a specific thing at a certain time. But there's also music when you pick up a Triforce, which for some reason is in the game.
A piece of power.
An acorn. And how do you feel about that music?
Okay, so I think it would not be fair to leave this unsaid that this is obviously supposed to be their Mario Superstar music, right? Because when you get the piece of power, which makes you do, I think, like double damage, and then when you get the acorn, which makes you take half damage, they both get the same little like power-up music, and it doesn't last forever, right? Because the piece of power wears off just after a amount of time. So it's exactly like a superstar, right? You get this item, you're modified for a little while, and it's...
It's like 2 bars long.
And the thing that was really starting to burn it into my brain after a while and make me like question my sanity is... I struggled a little bit with a couple of the later dungeons, and like there was a couple times I just got like full on lost, and I made the mistake of like being like, oh man, I don't know where I am, and pausing and then like opening GameFAQs while I had a piece of power. And now that's just playing on a loop infinitely for all of time until there is no other sound in the universe. And like, it's not good. It's not good music, for one, because it's barely music, and two, it feels kind of like the side-scrolling platforming segments. It feels kind of out of place to be like, oh, I'm the hero. Now I'm the hero super high. Like, it's like, I don't know. It's just weird. Like, it's just like the platforming sections visually. This is the audio version. Like, it just feels out of place.
Yeah, and it just like, I think... What is it? If you get hit a few times, you lose it. Or if you, sometimes when you like step into an indoor place or leave an indoor place, it just decides it's done.
Yeah, there, if, or, if you cross,
I don't know if it's like a certain number of screens.
If you cross certain boundaries, indoor, outdoor, and I think like upstairs, like into a dungeon, out of a dungeon. Because some dungeons you like wander in and out, but I think you're still considered in the dungeon. But yeah, so like certain door thresholds, taking a certain amount of damage or just time, like if you just stand still, time would eventually make you have it wear off. But
it's definitely longer than the star in Mario, which is like 20 seconds or something.
No, this is, I think if you're not taking damage and you don't cross a threshold, like I think it is like over a minute, which the same like two bars on loop for that long is a long time.
Yeah, it's pretty irritating. And it wouldn't be so bad if it was a rare drop from enemies.
No.
It's not
rare.
No,
it's all over the damn place. And again, we're going to, you know, give you some sneak peeks on mechanics here, but there's no traditional Zelda growth in this game. You don't have to power up your sword at all, right? There's like you don't get the Master Sword.
Yeah, you can, but it's not, you don't need
and it's
it.
Not in your face, right? The Master Sword is a core part of most of the games. This, the only reason I even knew I could power up my sword is because it says L1 under the sword.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I guess there are sword power-ups. And then I beat the game and never got any of them. And I was like, oh. but you don't, the Game Boy Color one has upgrades to the armor, but the original one didn't. And so there's like, nothing, there's no like avatar growth, right? Like Link only gets better if you, the player, really get better. And so I think the piece of power for your attack and the acorn, why is it an acorn? The acorn for your defense is one, their way of baking in a little bit of like growth opportunity. Like, oh, you got this thing and now you can behave differently in the world because you have been like your avatar has been modified. But it also just feels like another weird place that they were like, yeah, let's pull this other mechanic out of Mario and just, it works in Mario. Let's just do it over here. Right. And it's not, it doesn't break anything. It's not harmful, but it just feels out of place. And I feel like history has borne out that I'm probably right, because like, did any future Zelda games do anything like that? I don't think so.
Not really.
Yeah, cause it's kind of weird.
I guess we've already been sort of doing this, but how well does audio serve gameplay? I'm trying to see if there's anything in my notes that we didn't already kind of get to.
There's one specific thing we have to mention, which is the owl, your guide and protector. Every time you scroll the screen of text, he goes hoot hoot, hoot hoot again. So he hoot hoots when he's flying in. He hoot hoots every single time you scroll the screen of text, and then he hoot hoots on his way off the screen.
Oh, he's speaking. Well, I guess when he's flying in, he's speaking too.
Hey, Link. Yeah, it's not the best sound effect in the game, and it's not that it's like, it's not nails on a chalkboard bad, but it shouldn't be every single scroll of text, right? Because when you talk to Marin, it doesn't make a like lip flapping noise every time you scroll the text. So like, I would accept hoot hoot when the owl comes onto the screen and then when he leaves the screen, and that would be totally fine. But the fact that it's on and he talks a lot because he is the one telling you where to go and what to do. Like, he has the most NPC dialogue of any character in the game. So scrolling through every single screen of text and getting a hoot hoot on every screen is just, it's just bad sound design. It's just not a good use of that noise.
He likes to wax poetic about the dreamer for quite a bit, which it's fine. It's part of the plot, but yeah, he's definitely got the gift of long-windedness,
which wouldn't bother me nearly as much without that noise. Like, if we're going to talk about sound impacting gameplay, that makes me want to scroll through the text either way slower so that there's more time in between hoot hoots, or way faster to just get him the hell out of there. And because he is giving you vital information you absolutely must have to beat the game, I shouldn't be thinking about dragging it out and not paying attention, or rushing through it and not paying attention. You ready to move on to controls and mechanics?
I sure am.
So before we talk about anything else, I need to ask you this, because you owned a Game Boy. I didn't. I played some Game Boy games, but I don't have the memory for them that you surely do. Is squeeze the entire Game Boy to get to the menu a normal input on other Game Boy games?
You mean like the A, B, select, and start all at once?
Yeah.
Yes. It was actually pretty common for Nintendo's games. Which is a direct result of not giving you enough buttons, which is going to be a definite topic for this game. let's start off with the good stuff, though. I don't think I'd have that long of a list. I'd say, you know, first off on the positive, Link is very responsive. You can still move diagonally, which wasn't true in the first Zelda game, or in, you know, for that matter, the second one. But it was in Link to the Past, and they preserved that, and that's such a nice thing to have when you're trying to maneuver around enemies and or, you know, fight the bosses. You know, I can think of Final Fantasy Adventure, which takes a very Zelda-like design with the overhead view, does not have diagonal, and that makes it so much more annoying to fight. So that's nice. I'm trying to see, is there any other positive thing I'd say? I mean, your weapons, using them feels responsive. You know, I'm pretty comfortable with what's going to happen when I let the slingshot out, or how fast these different items get released is pretty satisfying.
Well, and there's, again, I don't think there's a lot of variation. So like when you use the sword behaves like the sword every time. When you use the boomerang behaves like the boomerang every time, right? And there's even little differences that might make you opt for one over the other. So like you can throw the boomerang diagonal, which is kind of cool. But the biggest difference between the boomerang and the hookshot isn't that the hookshot can go a little bit further, because the boomerang can cover like 3/4 of the screen. The biggest difference is after you throw the boomerang, you can keep moving. Once the hookshot leaves, you are in place until it comes back to you. So if you shoot it at an enemy that's like 2 squares in front of you and you miss and there's nothing on the other side, like you are now immobilized until the hookshot gets back, right? So there's some little differences even between similar tools that would make you consider using one over the other, right? Like the bow and arrow, oddly, the arrow does not travel all that fast, right? So you kind of have to aim it a little bit more thoughtfully than you would with the hookshot, because if you miss with the hookshot, you just do it again, but like you run out of arrows, right? So the differences between the weapons feels consistent and understandable, and actually makes you think about like, oh, do I want to be immobilized after I use this ranged attack, or would I like to be able to keep moving?
Well, in a notable difference from the Super Nintendo Zelda, you don't see the bow, and there's no, like, in the Super Nintendo one, there's, like, your timing is a factor because there's a lag. Like, he pulls and draws the arrow and then releases it, and so you kind of got to, like, aim ahead of who you're, and the arrows don't move that fast in the Super Nintendo one either. But it's almost like it might as well be a spear he's throwing, because it just kind of flies out of
them. Yeah, they're freaking javelins. Like, and so when I got to the first dungeon that encourages you to have the bow, you don't need the bow to complete that dungeon. I think it's like the fifth one. But there's the weird like winged items, you know, which is kind of an interesting thing. But there's like the winged items, and I saw what I thought was the hook shot, and I was just like, oh, and I jumped up and got it, and I was like, nothing happened. Is this the false hook shot? And it wasn't until after I got the bow that I was like, oh, that's what arrows look like. The arrows are huge, and you don't see the bow animation. So they just, these giant javelins just come flying out of your face. It's not the best visual, and it's very much a limitation of the graphics. Like, if they made a thinner arrow, you just wouldn't be able to see what the hell was happening.
Especially because the original Game Boy, the screen ghosted like crazy. Like, anything moving, I can see why Zelda's a good game for it, because the background does not scroll unless you're changing screens, which is a pain on the Mario games. If you play them on original hardware, it's just like a smeared mess.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and I remember some of the, I think maybe one of the Wario games maybe did almost like Mega Man style screen scrolls so that they could limit the amount of time. So the screen wasn't just constantly moving like it is in most Mario games. Yeah. And I never thought about it, but that is probably why they did that.
Oh, man.
Any other positive things? I like that you can jump. Jumping's cool.
It is cool. I don't want to spoil mechanics. It controls very well. And it actually makes navigating a lot easier, avoiding enemies, because half the enemies, I can just hop over them and it's like, whatever, I don't need to fight you.
You don't drop experience. I don't care about this.
Pretty much. So, yeah, the jumping feels great. And, you know, it's a weird Mario mechanic we'll get to, but they gave you those floating items and they gave you pits you got to jump over. And, you know, I don't know if you bumped into this, but you can technically jump over two squares if you time your jump really well.
Yeah, you
can. And that's pretty nice to skip some things that they maybe didn't expect you to necessarily jump across right away.
And I think once you get the Pegasus boots, you can do over three. Right?
Yeah, at least three, because they force you to do it. But
I do feel like the jumping in the overworld sections actually feels pretty good and controls pretty well. And the jumping in the platforming sections still controls okay, but it doesn't feel very good because the visuals are kind of askew and everything's sort of wonky. Yeah. But it's I felt like, oh, okay, this is an interesting way to add some interaction to the world. They don't allow you to jump up ledges, right? It's not like, oh, I fell down this ledge, I need to jump back up. Nope, that's not how jumping works. Like, jumping is a tool like any other tool to interact with certain parts of the map. Excuse me. And and that's like, the fact that they are consistent about that means you don't stand there and try to jump up a wall. You are never, ever going to be able to jump up, because it never, ever happens.
Yeah. And in true Nintendo like quality, jumping isn't just for pits. There's also a mini boss around the idea that you need to jump a guy that pushes that big rolling spike thing. And so they immediately give you a reason to use it, that it's like, you really can't beat this guy unless you can jump. And so, you know, throughout the game, and not to hop into mechanics
do it,
yet.
Do it. Controls and mechanics live together.
I got one giant complaint that I feel like you're going to have too, so I don't know if you want me to break the seal on it.
Oh, no. I mean, one of us has to, and you're already on your way, so go for it.
Okay. The biggest problem I have with the controls comes down to not having enough buttons on the Game
Nowhere
Boy.
Nowhere near enough.
And so, and this doesn't feel like a clever design choice to limit you. It really comes down to, this is all the buttons we have. And so you can equip two things at a time. And while they do lots of interesting things, getting you to mix things like the boots and the feathers so that you can run and jump, especially the further you get into the game, the more it feels like you have to pause and change items on every single screen.
Sometimes like, more than once, like, oh, the puzzles get complicated.
Yeah, and so you're like, I got to go from the town to, say, this dungeon over here, and it may only be five screens over. Well, that's anywhere from 5 to 10 inventory hops. And I just find that, like, irritating. And, like, by the end of the game, I was just exhausted with having to pause and switch. And even doing that, like, you know, part of my muscle memory wants B to be like cancel out. And so I would be trying to leave the inventory and I would put something else back into B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, well, I would say probably like 1 out of 4 times, right? Which is a lot of wasted time.
Yeah. So that sense that you are pausing nonstop in this game is probably the single greatest thing I would hold against it, is not aging well.
It not only does it not age well, but I have a hard time believing people didn't notice this 20 years ago. Like, I can almost guarantee by the end of playing this the first time, you know, 10 or 12 year old Mike was just like, man, I sure did have to pause that a lot. You know, as you stroked your beard and sipped your whiskey, you're like, man, it's just so many pauses.
Like, imagine you had to write a paper, but you only had 10 letters you could use at a time when you're typing words, and you had to go into your bag and replace keys on your keyboard.
Yeah. I will say, in their defense-ish, they didn't try to do anything clever and say like, well, if you quickly triple tap A, it uses this item. And if you, you know, if you long hold and then, you know, if you do Morse code and tap dancing, then we will make them behave as other buttons because it's an action game. And that kind of crap would be way more error prone and way less fun in basically every way. That being said, there are, I think, a couple exceptions they could have made. One is once you have the power bracelet should just be equipped. Why in God's name? And I know they thought about making the collision between Link and anything in the world really obvious in the game engine, because every single time you touch anything that requires you to have the power bracelet equipped, it tells you that you don't have the power bracelet equipped. So the fact that the game engine collision is that strict means they could just say, hey, we know he has the sword equipped right now, but because he is leaning his face into a rock and pressing A, just pick up the rock. They made the flippers a passive item. Why the hell couldn't they make this a passive item? And then I feel that kind of the same with the Pegasus boots. Like if you have maybe like the shield equipped or something and you like long press B, or maybe the Pegasus boots would be an acceptable time to, no, because you have to be able to jump and do Pegasus boots same time. Okay, the power bracelet, though. I stand by the power bracelet should be a passive item.
I've got one for the boots. It's the convention of double tap the arrow of which direction, like double tap in the same direction you start dashing.
There you go.
Double tap and hold on the second press.
Yes, double click and drag. Yes.
Yes. I think that would work. And so, yeah, there could have been some clever workarounds for a few of the items, but I think it would still end up being a switch fest.
The only reason... So there's a lot of puzzles and a lot of ways they gate your flow through the map with crap you can't pick up and crap you can't jump over, right? Like, that's the core of how Zelda, like... fences you into certain parts of the map is you don't have the item to get from here to there. And
yeah,
if they had done just the power bracelet and the Pegasus boots with you know, like quick actions basically, or ambient passive item equips, then that's just two less times you would ever have to do that. And in some of the later dungeons, the amount of times you need to switch back to the power bracelet is like every screen.
Yeah, and like the very early part of the game, there's a rock blocking almost everything. And so that would have, even just that one becoming passive would have made it, it would have gone a long way to not feeling like I was pausing every single screen.
Yeah, that's, and I... Again, I don't think any other Zelda game makes the power bracelet an item that you have to equip. It is a passive item. And again, I know that this game has a concept of passive items because you have the secret medicine, you have the flippers, you have keys. When you have a key and you touch a key door, it just works.
Yeah.
If you don't have a key, it doesn't. So the game already has this entire concept in place.
Yeah.
Yeah, this feels like a... I don't want to say a sloppy mistake. This almost feels like an intentional experiment. Like, what if the power bracelet was an item you used to interact with the world, just like the sword or the bombs?
Yeah.
And they tried it, and turns out it sucks. But I don't think they didn't understand what passive equips were. The power bracelet had already been a passive equip in two games, right? Yeah. So like they already had this mechanic in place. I think this was an intentional experimentation.
I want to support that viewpoint of yours. The shield in this game is the first and maybe only time the shield is a button you press in a Zelda game. Other than the 3D ones, eventually
in the 2D ones, it's the first time that you have to shield.
Which they teach you very immediately in the game because you can't get through the puffball, whatever, the urchins to get your sword without pushing them with the shield.
Yeah, you have to like hold the shield up and then shove them. Yeah.
And so that was, you know, right away in the game, it's this thing that used to be passive is now a choice. You have to equip it and press it to use it. And so, you know, there's a purity in that they do that with every item other than... No, I just lost my train.
Other than the flippers, other than keys,
yeah.
Secret medicine. I'm going to say that might be it.
So, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind is I get why they didn't do this because of the physical button itself, but do you feel like the map had to have its own button that only does the map for the entire game? I feel like the map could have been something you highlight in the menu when you want to see it, and that would have freed up an entire other button, admittedly a very inconvenient button that tempts you to take your hand off the plus pad, if not.
I'm more annoyed that when you're in the dungeon map is in the equipment item, but if you hit select because your brain thinks map, it goes to the totally pointless overworld map. So... yeah, I wish when you were in a dungeon, the map brought up the map dungeon. And when you were on the overworld, it brought up the overworld map, because zero times on this playthrough was I like, where am I in the overworld while I was in a dungeon? That information never mattered to me.
That's true. And I mean, I'd have to say this was an era where Nintendo was figuring out that maps were awesome to include in their adventure games, but this has to be maybe the worst one they ever shipped. And it's not useless, but I don't like it.
Well, and I'll tell you this, there were very few times in this game, and I didn't think to mention this during visuals, but there were very few times in this game where I looked at the visuals and I was like, oh man, because you know, they're blown up on a TV. I was playing on Super Game Boy, so it's like they're huge. But there were still very few times that I was like, wow, these did not scale well. This looks terrible. But the map, the overworld map, when you bring up the overworld map on like a large television, you're just like, what is this? Like, it gives you just the most basic information, like, oh, the town is roughly over there. And the mountain is roughly over there. And the ocean is roughly over there, which is, I mean, it's better than nothing. Like, I'm glad that I had a map, but... there's so much information they're trying to communicate on, what was the Game Boy screen, like 3 inches, a little tiny square, like
150 pixels by whatever.
Yeah, so I mean, there's just so much information they were trying to convey on there, and I mean, God bless them for squeezing so much in, but when you see that blown up, you're just like, ugh.
Oh, and like, we're in mechanics now, I'm just saying, but if you're using the map to try to figure out, oh, I'm here and I want to get over here, the way the game is actually built, that's not very useful.
No, it's not useful for that at all.
The game is the actual traversal of this game is less like an open world and more like a series of linear loops that occasionally branch into each other. And so it's like, oh, I'm here and three squares over is that dungeon. But actually, you got to go way up here and hop down this and go around this and go through this cave. And that's how you get to it.
Which the map does not communicate in the slightest or even attempt to. It's not like it communicates it poorly. It does not communicate that information to you at all.
And the most it can do is like, oh, you once talked to an owl here. So you want to read that again? Here's what he said. So, yeah, the map is kind of a letdown, let's just say.
Well, especially after the Link to the Past map, which is pretty friggin' useful, right? Like, you always have a pretty good idea of where you are, where you need to go, and if there is a more or less straight path between those two things. Like, oh, do I need to cross water? Do I need to cross mountains? Do I need to go underground? Like, the Link to the Past map gave you a lot of that information, or at least enough detail to remind you when you looked at the map the second time, like, oh, right, it looks like I could go over there, but actually I would have to jump over the water and I don't have the flippers, right? But this map does not convey any of that information, which leads you as the player to have to just memorize where a lot of crap is.
Yeah. And very related to that, the warping in this game is another downgrade from Link to the Past.
It's a huge downgrade. Smaller map, but nowhere near as good.
In Link to the Past, once you have the bird and the ocarina song that lets you warp, you get a very granular, I think it's 8 or 9 spots on the map you can drop off at, if not more. I can't remember the exact number. But in this game, there's only 4, and there's not an interface for choosing exactly where you want to drop. You just have to go hop on the warp cycle and just get off the ride once you're where you want to be. And it's just more irritating. It's just not as good.
Yeah, and it feels like they, because there's only four, because the world is so much smaller, because the game overall is a smaller game, they just kind of decided, like, yeah, we don't need to create a whole UI for four things. The game, it loads nearly instantly, so we're just going to make you scroll through all of them. But it does feel weird to get on the subway, get off, look at the map, and then get back on the subway. And it's like, can I just look at the map, then get on the subway and stay on until my exit? Nope. No, yeah. You cannot.
And because of the aforementioned, like, pathfinding is so not related to viewing the map that you may drop off somewhere and still realize, actually, to get there, this isn't the best place to drop off.
Yeah, it's navigating the world does feel, the overworld feels more like the dungeons than I think they ever have before, where screen to screen, there may only be literally one square that connects two screens and it's blocked by a rock, yeah. Right? So it feels like a puzzle that you would encounter in a dungeon, except it's everywhere you go.
Yeah. It's claustrophobic and it's exhausting.
Yeah. Exhausting, I think, is a good term for it, because every time you walk one screen left, and then you realize, oh, I actually need to go back and then go up and then go one screen left. Even though I'll still be on the same two screens, I just need to be like up one more square because of how tight the bottleneck is. Exhausting is the right way to describe that, because every time that happens, you go, because it doesn't feel like, oh, I'll eventually remember this. It's just like, God damn it.
Yeah.
So I want to, if we can, I want to end at least a semi-positive note on the control part, is to connect this more officially to mechanics, is this game does what every Zelda game does, but it still does it really, really well. And I really appreciate it, and they deserve a high five for it. When you get a new toy, you are immediately forced to learn how to use that toy. You cannot go from point A to point B in the game after acquiring a new item and not understand exactly how it works, because you're going to need that tool to solve puzzles. So they don't want anyone to ever say, like, oh, I didn't know that that's what it did. They're like, that's not fair. And it's like, nope, you literally cannot get past sometimes the next screen without knowing exactly how the hookshot works, or the magic rod works, or the whatever works. Like the shield right in the beginning of the game, the sword, right after you get sword, they're like, you should probably stab that thing to death, right? And so like they make you learn how everything works, which means even though the controls are very clunky, and I do disagree with some of their design choices, you can never say, I didn't know how the controls worked, I don't know how to use this item, because you cannot get from here to there without crossing that bridge. Sometimes literally a bridge.
And sprinkling on, like, the bonus on top is they also do the Zelda and Metroid thing of dangling pieces of heart and other items or treasure chests out of reach, requiring those items. So it's not just, oh, to beat this dungeon, you need this, but also remember that thing you couldn't get to before? Now you want to go get it. And so it's something every Zelda game, every modern Zelda game does, but they also did it here. And so, yeah, high five.
Yeah. I think we also need to talk about what I just consider trying everything they could think of in terms of mechanics in the game. They sat down and just listed all of the things they could think of, and then whoever the director was for the game said, yeah. And everybody in the room was like, no, we asked you which mechanics to pick. And he realized he hadn't been paying attention. And he was just like, yeah, no, yeah, yeah. These, these all sound good. Like I can't pick a favorite child. I think, you know what? I think we should just do them all. And he didn't realize the list had like 100 things on it. And so that is what they did. They took all of the things you can think about from like Link to the Past and added platforming. Two of the bosses, I think, you fight in a side-scrolling platforming layout. There's key blocks, so there's an additional thing that you have to use keys on besides just doors. There's the green crystals that you can only go through if you're using the Pegasus boots. They added the concept of mini-bosses, some of which come back if you go back to that room. So like you have to try not to get lost when you're in the dungeon, otherwise you'll have to fight the boss again, which adds an additional challenge. The bomb walls that I mentioned, you have to poke. Some of the bosses have weird weaknesses to like other side items. There's a little bit of swimming. Like there's just some of the, in the, I think the very last dungeon or the second to last dungeon, there's a platform, like a platforming section with a puzzle in it where you have to use the magic rod to melt the ice blocks. And if you melt the wrong ones, you can't platform off of them. Like so many mechanics, so much stuff that is not considered like standard Zelda. And they just tried it all.
Yeah. Those ice blocks, you know, wonderfully every time you bump them. Yep. Text. Just going to remind you again.
Even if you have the fire rod equipped, that's the most egregious one, because even if you have the fire rod equipped, and the same thing with the green crystals with the Pegasus boots, like I have the right item on, leave me alone. Like,
well, and because of the nature of the side scrolling sections, you are jumping into those. So you're even more likely to trigger the text. So
worst design decision in the entire game, worse than the controls.
Yeah. So I don't know if these were part of what you were thinking of, saying that every single game mechanic ever was tried in this, but there's weird games of chance mixed in, like rolling the little horse dice or hitting the card suit guys to make them match. Yeah. Or there's even a few old fashioned classic 8-bit style, you have to kill these enemies in the right order type thing. Ooh,
the first time I encountered that, I was pissed. Because they do nothing to communicate that to you. Like,
yeah, I think you'd have to find the special beak to get a message about it, and that's about it.
Maybe I was like, beak, whatever. But I don't remember having that information given to me in the game. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say it was there and I just missed it. But I definitely got stuck in this one dungeon and I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to open game facts. And it was like, oh, kill these three enemies in this order. And I was like, how would I have known that? Like, yeah. Because the three, the like suits, they have like, you know, like playing card suits, and you have to kill them. When you hit them, they freeze on one suit, and to kill them, you have to get all three of them to freeze on the same suit. And when you don't do that, it goes, and when you throw the knights, the chess pieces, which, why? What? But when you throw those and they don't both land upright, you get the, like when you are in a room with enemies you need to kill in a certain order and you don't kill them in that order, hey, reuse that sound effect you had for communicating to the player that they failed at a puzzle. Like, you've already thought about this problem.
Yeah. And I mean, I just have to say, as far as a gameplay challenge in a Zelda game, the card suit enemies and the knight dice throw are not long-term satisfying challenges. They're just games of chance. They're just, well, guess I got to sit here rolling these till I can get through.
Yeah. It's the knight pieces. You don't fight. Like, they're just objects you pick up and throw. So at least you can fairly quickly blaze through that. But the trying to get the three suits to stop on the same suit at the same time, that is just boring. Boring. What do you call it? Like a boring slot machine, right? Like I didn't win.
When there's that, is it the eagle? There's the dungeon where you have to knock down all the pillars with the little ball that you carry around with you. And maybe there's a way to get around this, but I didn't find it. I found myself having to swing through some like boulders in my way or throw things like bombs at them. There was one of those card suit puzzles where I couldn't just go straight over to them. And so it kind of felt like I was waiting for their random pathfinding to wander towards
me. Yeah. Do you have a ranged weapon by that point?
Yeah, but there's like the square blocks in the way in between me and them. And like you solve their puzzle to make a treasure chest appear, which you can hookshot to get across.
Oh.
And maybe there's like, I felt like maybe there was a way around the dungeon where I didn't have to leave the floor, which resets their puzzle. But I didn't find it. So I had to like try to solve them through a wall, which was not.
So now you're playing a slot machine that you don't want to be playing in a really uncomfortable chair. And it's like, why am I doing this? Yeah, you're right. It not satisfying is a good way to describe a couple of these mechanics where you're just like, well, I did it, I guess. But you don't really feel that good about it. Even like the throwing the knights isn't hard, but it just it's just like it's a stupid open sesame trick. You're just like, okay, I did it.
Yeah.
So we kind of talked about this earlier, but I want to know, like, do you honestly feel like the game is babying you, or are they leaving you to your own devices? And I think this is a good time for me to ask you this question explicitly, because there's all of the Zelda mechanics you know and love, and then there's like 80,000 more Zelda mechanics, and most of them are conveyed entirely through gameplay, right? The stupid owl doesn't come down and hoot hoot and tell you how the suit enemies work, or how the knight pieces work, or how, like, basically anything in the dungeon works, right? Like, all those puzzles,
yeah.
The like, interacting with things isn't really spelled out for you, even when they keep shoving text down your throat. So, like, the green crystals, it was not clear to me that the Pegasus boots was how you defeated those, because it literally says something like, there must be some way to get past this. And it's like,
this is weird.
Yeah. So like, part of me felt like, oh, they're really trying to hold my hand by, like, reminding me, like, oh, you need to use this item. But then they just, it's like a bad teacher just keeps saying, like, no, no, no. Yeah, and it's like, yes, no, I get it. I'm doing it wrong. Can you help me do it right?
Yeah. I mean, aside from the beak wall structure things, which was a weird adaptation of just the, you know, the empty, like, stone tablet thing from the Super Nintendo one, those occasionally give you info on, like, a key core mechanic of that dungeon of, like, oh, you need to do this, or this enemy, you need to actually bump the turtles with your shield, and then you can finally hurt them. But aside from that, there are these mechanics where it's like, you're so hand-holding about these other things, and you got nothing to say about this when I actually might like some help.
Yeah, this is what makes me question, like, are they being super hand-holdy, or is it that they didn't realize this information being given to you again just becomes an annoyance? And because this was actually the last Zelda game they made before Ocarina of Time, I know one of my favorite Ocarina of Time complaints that existed in basically every Zelda game thereafter is when you, so we didn't mention explicitly, you pick up items like that are floating in the sky and they have like little angel wings. And yeah. And I actually kind of like that, because a lot of the puzzles require certain items, or certain items make the puzzle like way easier, and or certain enemies like that you have to beat to get the door to open or whatever. And I sort of like that there's these like magic flying items, because every time I saw a magic flying item, I was like, aha, bombs. I need to be thinking, what can I do with bombs? Right. And it just put me in the right mindset. And something about getting bombs out of a treasure chest has just never, it's never done that same trigger to me. Like, and I'm not blaming the game. Like, I know this is my game's literacy, but opening a chest and getting bombs never made me say, like, ah, I need to be thinking about using bombs to solve like the next room or the next fight that I do or whatever. But the wings totally did. And it's an infinite supply. So if you run out of bombs and you screw up the puzzle, you can go back and the floaty angel bombs are there again. Right. So it's like, it's their way of just being like, yeah, okay, you need bombs to solve this puzzle. Here's bombs. Here's all the bombs you need. Right. Here's all the arrows you need or whatever. And where I found that to be, super hilarious thinking about later Zelda games is every time you pick up bombs, starting from Ocarina of Time onward, it's like, you got bombs. Here's some things you can do with bombs. And it's like, I know. And then in like the later games, they even are like, they tell you how you should feel about the rupees you just got. So like a small amount of rupees is like, yay. And then like a lot of rupees is like, this is the best. And then like, God, was it Skyward Sword that had the negative rupees? And it literally says like, and that's a little sad. It's like, ah, why are you doing this to me? Could you imagine in Link to the Past if every time the thief hit you and you dropped a bunch of your items, all of the animation stopped and some text popped up and was like, that's a little sad. Like, you would never play that game. It would be horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, Nintendo's rapidly diminishing trust in the player. And it wasn't a coherent lack of trust in this game, because they obviously did trust you in some places, but it was a huge swing in that direction. And it's remains the, you know, part of the biggest paper cut of playing this game. And I wonder how much of that they'll keep in the remake, and also if the button nonsense will be over, because it'll be like, yeah.
If they don't bother to modernize the buttons on a controller that has three times as many buttons, and if they don't, no, four times as many buttons. So if they don't bother to modernize the buttons, and if they don't bother to remove the "you touched a pot, you don't have the thing to pick up the pot, so we're going to remind you again that you can't pick up a pot," because Link to the Past already solved this problem. When you try to pick up something that's too heavy, you can't pick it up. And you see him trying, but he can't, right? So like, there's all of the information you need. I'm trying, but I can't. Like, I don't need the text box every time. And if they successfully remake this game, but unsuccessfully fix those specific two blemishes, I will honestly consider the remake a failure, because no amount of auditory and graphical improvements could possibly make up for those two things. At this era in 1993, okay, I don't like it, but I get it. But in 2019, no, unacceptable, unacceptable.
We know better. And you don't have the excuse of the hardware, like, not being capable or whatever.
There are none of the limitations you could even generously extend to them as being the excuses for why they made those design choices. Like, oh, well, it's a really small screen and you wouldn't be able to tell that Link is trying to pick up the thing, but he can't because it's not like on the Super Nintendo where you could see him sweating. So, yeah, okay, fine. Maybe that was a reason. But on the Switch, they're just not going to be able to say any of that. It's not that they don't have enough buttons. It's not that they can't visually convey the information. It's not that you can't even just expect the player to have the game's literacy to see what's happening and draw a conclusion, right? So, yeah, I'm going to wait till, like, after the first reviews come out. And if they say, like, oh, the text is still there, it's like, nope, sorry, Nintendo. You could have had my money, but now screw you.
Yeah. I guess to have a little positivity, because... I actually do like this game a lot, in spite of all this. I'd say in general, the dungeons are very enjoyable. The boss fights are wonderfully enjoyable, and they do rip a lot of bosses from the Super Nintendo Link to the Past, and it still plays well. But you know, you kind of want to be like, all right, you know, you didn't think of a new thing. We're fighting the little worm thing again. But they did come up with some new ones. The genie is an interesting boss fight who, you know, directly relates to the pots you've been picking up the entire dungeon. And then he's a giant pot, and you break him out of his pot, and then you, you know, dodge fireballs and hit him. But, the eagle boss is kind of like Mega Man X Storm Eagle, and then he tries to blow you off.
He's totally like Mega Man X Storm Eagle. I knew something about that felt familiar, but I did not connect those two things, so thank you for that.
Yes. And so overall, though, they're nice caps to mostly satisfying dungeons, and despite some of the weirder mechanics, the dungeons are all, you know, different and interesting in their own way. You know, secret walls, and you know, one of the dungeons, you literally, I don't think any prior Zelda game had done this. Unless, does Link to the Past have any mechanic where you literally destroy the foundations and collapse one of the dungeons down? Does Turtle Rock do that? No?
I mean, you go into a couple of the dungeons through like a pretty spectacular animation, but none of them have a mechanic where you appear to be altering the layout of the physical building to progress through it. So that was pretty unique as far as I can think.
Yeah, and I mean, not to crap on it, but like, it really kind of just gets you through the last door in the dungeon.
Yeah.
But it is a core, like the core puzzle that's throughout the dungeon, which makes use of very interesting you know, you're taking this ball around, which in general Game Boy games, I think, were very light on memory, and so like having to remember where you left that, and like they probably had to jump through some hoops to be like, all right, in this dungeon we need some extra magic to make this work. And so, you know, I don't know that I like any of these dungeons more than the Super Nintendo games dungeons, or that they're necessarily more creative, but they are still good. And they're, you know, and that's probably just a mark that you want to give this game for being that good on a Game Boy.
Yeah, and I hesitate to say, wow, this is really good for a Game Boy game, right? Because in terms of the visuals, I would say these are really good visuals for the Game Boy. This is really good, mostly audio for the Game Boy, right? But in terms of mechanics, like very, you know, the variation in mechanics and the level design and the lessons that they learned from Link to the Past, and they tried to not just copy paste it, but also say like, oh, can we do more things? Can we do new things from a design perspective, right? Because it's very different to say, oh, how can we push this hardware to its limits? When you're designing a puzzle game, you don't necessarily need all that much in terms of processing power. You just need to be clever in your level design so that you can make the player think and have an interesting and challenging experience. And they absolutely do that. Like, you could, and we are probably about to see them take this game and graphically improve it, but not really change the puzzles, not really change the way you move through the dungeons. I really hope they change the way you move through the world, but the complexity of the dungeon puzzles is as good as the Super Nintendo counterpart. I wouldn't say I necessarily enjoy them more or less, but in terms of like creativity and design and interesting things, yeah, I would say they're every bit as good as the Super Nintendo ones, which is part of why this game is good, because they didn't try to do things yeah. that would be impossible on the Game Boy. Like, you can only solve this puzzle if you notice this minor visual distinction, right? Like, that wouldn't be any fun. So they said like, oh, yeah. we have to have crazy layouts, and you're going to have to backtrack, and you're going to have to remember where you left things. And like, that's good. Like, it works really well in this context.
So that kind of leads us to, does it hold up?
So for me, as a first-time player, I did not require any nostalgia goggles to enjoy this, by which I mean I didn't have to say, like, well, for a Game Boy game from 1993. That being yeah. said, thinking about it in the context of they're going to remake this, or they're remaking this right now, if I'm deadly serious. If they did not fix the buttons, which they have no excuse for, and if they left in the helping, not helping text every time you touch an item that you don't yet have the tool to interact with, I will consider that a catastrophic failure. Like, I can forgive yeah. that at this time in history, because even with all of the games literacy I have acquired in the intervening, you know, several decades, I still get why they would have chosen to do that at this time in history. And I can play the game and learn to not get near a pot, right? So like, I actually learned to move through the universe in a slightly different way, because I didn't want to keep seeing those little pop-up screens. And so that made it, that made me able to say, I'm not playing this with nostalgia goggles, because I still hate this mechanic, but I found a way to deal with it that makes the game still fun. Or not mechanic, this design choice. But I found a way to deal with it where I'm still having fun playing the game. I'm still enjoying the puzzles. I'm still enjoying the story, such as it is. Like, it's still good. So, you know, no nostalgia goggles required for me for the DX. I don't know why they did that for Game Boy games at this time, but for the,
Deluxe.
Yeah, I know, but for the color, you know, pseudo remake of the original. But I'm still withholding judgment for the remake. Cause it, to me, it is not a slam dunk to remake this game. There are things they need to fix in the remake.
Yeah. And I have to say, just from the little trailer they released, it looks like they're doing basically tile for tile the same screens. So I'm a little worried, but to be like, navigation may still be kind of annoying, but if they fix the buttons and they fix the text prompts everywhere, then that could go a long way. I'm with you. This is still a very good game, even without nostalgia goggles. But if someone were wanting to try a Zelda game, it wouldn't be the first one I'd say play. I'd say play Link to the Past, or you know, maybe the most recent Breath of the Wild. And then if you discover I like Zelda games, then I'd be like, this one is worth, if you know you like Zelda games, it's definitely worth playing.
The curtain falls, the music plays, the credits roll, then it all fades to black, and you're left by yourself. The fanfare is gone, there's no player two there by your side to share victories won. But as you slowly progress down the hall to your bed, a few great events leak back into your head from the time that you spent traversing the land, battling evil, fighting the darkness, just sword in hand. Your memories creep in with the edge of a smile. You realize again what you've lost for a while. You're gonna think back much less on how you saved the day than on all the experience you gained.
The ride.